This is a CNA podcast.
This is Heart of the Matter, and I'm Lin Su Ling. Trace Together, when the contact tracing smartphone app was first rolled out in March, it was upheld with some level of pride as a sign of Smart Nation Singapore leveraging technology to tackle the scourge of COVID-19. But over the last 3 months, teething tech issues, low adoption rates, and lingering questions over sharing of personal information surfaced. In a few weeks, a new Trace Together wearable device will be rolled out. The government has taken pains to clarify it would not collect personal data and explain how crucial this is for effective contact tracing. But some remain unconvinced of the need for a new Bluetooth token. What accounts for this resistance? What lies beneath concerns of making it mandatory and other trade-offs between privacy and fighting a pandemic inevitable? Joining me to tackle these issues and more on this week's episode are Dr. Janil Puthucheary, Minister in Charge of GovTech.
Hi, thank you very much for having me. Looking forward to the conversation.
Assistant Professor Hannah Clapham, Infectious Disease Expert at the NUS Saw Swee Hock School of Public Health.
Hi, thanks for having me. Great to be here.
And Brian Tan, Technology Law Specialist and Partner at law firm Pinson Masons.
Hi, good morning everyone. Pleased to be here too.
Great. I want to dive into the concerns and we'll get into the tech later, but perhaps we could ask Janil to start us off first and set the context. How different is Singapore's contact tracing today compared to, I suppose, SARS in 2003? And are we keeping pace with how dangerous and infectious COVID has turned out to be?
Well, there is quite a lot of difference in terms of the scale and the speed of what we have to do. Contact tracing, if you look around the world, is one of those things where there really is no doubt that this is a key part of the strategy any nation, any city has to put in place in order to fight COVID-19. And especially the more that we've learned about asymptomatic transmission, fairly well people carrying the disease, and really how infectious it is in the early stages of the disease, that speed of contact tracing really is a core part of the strategy. You can have all the swab tests that you can have quarantine facilities, you can have hospital facilities, but what links it all together is this ability to say, this person we know has the disease, and this is the bubble of people around them who are now at risk. And that's forward contact tracing. So what we're doing with Trace Together is to augment what is really a healthcare professional process, which we have scaled up and increased in size and speed and complexity compared to what we've done with SARS. The use of technology has already started to prove itself, bringing down the time taken from several days now to about a day or less even. And Trace Together is just one part of that overall use of technology to augment contact tracing. So it's a strategy demonstrated around the world to be the right thing to do. And the question now is how to make it work better and faster for us here in Singapore.
So Hannah, if I could get you to weigh in from an infectious disease expert, I think most people generally agree that tech is necessary, but we all know that tech is not a silver bullet. So when you think about Trace Together, do you think it's clear to the public what the specific benefits of Trace Together is? Have you seen examples of how this technology has made some difference in fighting the disease?
Yeah, thanks. It's a really important question, I think, in convincing people why we need this extra bit there. And as the Minister said, contact tracing is a vital part of controlling this disease. We're not going to do it without. And as the Minister said, contact tracing needs to happen as quickly as possible. And that's one of the big reasons why tech is important. There's a couple of other reasons why tech might be useful for augmenting it. I'm on the record in other places saying that tech is not the only way of doing this. And that's a really important point to make here. But it does help it happen faster. It helps as we get to a position where we are opening back up, we're going to see more cases. That's going to be happening. We're testing more, we're finding more cases. And so there's going to be more people to contact trace. And we need that to also continue to be able to trace more people over time. And tech is really going to help with that. The other thing that tech can help with is that it can help get at different contacts. So if we ask someone who they've been in contact with, they know certain people, they're able to give that information, they're able to find that. But there's other contacts that might be important for transmission that tech can help with. And I think that's where the app and the token are important parts coming together to enable that broad coverage of those contacts that can be traced.
But while people agree that it is important to build this stronger, more resilient system in terms of contact tracing, what specifically is tech doing that a system without this technology wouldn't be able to do? Dr. Janil, did you have something to add?
Yeah, I just wanted to pick up on Hannah's point about preparation for scale. Because one of the things we've been able to do in the circuit breaker is prepare to come out of it.
Right.
And part of that preparation is to sort of anticipate what if we have more cases in the future. What is it that we can do with more cases in a different way so that we, as a nation, all don't have to go down into a circuit breaker or what other countries have had as a lockdown again? And really, the way to do that is you've got to isolate the people around that positive contact. So you have a community or a small group of people who have a circuit breaker experience without all of us going through that. What we've been able to do during the circuit breaker process is scale up all of our abilities to do that. And TraceTogether is just part of that ability. So you ask, what is the role of tech in this? And it's really about increasing the speed, getting it down from several days, because you know in that several days, more people will be infected, but also increasing the scale. So instead of relying entirely on someone's memory and knowledge of that person's name and their phone number, you have an automated way of then getting knowledge of strangers that they may have come into contact with. And that's not possible without some form of device or some kind of way of logging those contacts. And that's what the technology is providing. It's an augmentation to the contact tracing process from the professional side, and it's an augmentation to your memory on the personal side. Who was I sitting next to? Who did I meet and who did I potentially infect?
Like, are you able to contact the other people who also have been identified by that? Is that what you're saying?
Well, the purpose of TraceTogether is to provide what's called forward contact tracing. That's, in other words, who have you been in touch with that you could now subsequently infect? And this includes risk to your loved ones and your families. So the technology, it's Bluetooth-based, and it logs other devices with the same Bluetooth technology that you have been in close proximity to. And it keeps all this private and encrypted on the device until you are positive. When you are positive, you surrender your device, and then the information of who you've been in contact with is now made available to MOH. So that's exactly it. Now, if you are positive, if I was a contact tracing professional, I can now contact all the people that are at risk around you, your friends, your family, but also strangers that you may have come into contact with so that they can be protected. So can that be done without technology? The answer is yes. I ask you, who did you have dinner with? Who did you speak to? Who was that delivery person that you spent half an hour talking to? You don't remember his name? Okay, I've got to go and find out now. But if I had a way to immediately have his phone number, I would be able to contact him within minutes, as opposed to perhaps the days that it might take to track down his company, his work shift, and whether he was indeed the delivery person who came and spoke face-to-face with you. So it's that speed that this technology allows, and it augments your memory.
Okay, I just wanted to bring the conversation forward to the announcement of the TraceTogether wearable device. When Minister Vivian Balakrishnan announced it last week, it gained some reactions, notably a petition that has tens of thousands of names. But Minister Vivian took great pains to explain that the multi-ministry task force, this is not going to track your GPS location. This also discussed how this is an important part of Singapore's contact tracing efforts. Now, as part of you being the minister in charge of Smart Nation, GovTech as well, could you also weigh in whether you're surprised by all these reactions so far? How different are these from the responses of past government initiatives? Because a lot of these are kind of not new.
Well, I think for some reason there was this idea that this device would have GPS and cellular connectivity and we would track people on a live basis. I'm not sure where that information came from, but we made it very clear this was going to be the same functionality that's already in the TraceTogether app. It's not going to have GPS, it's not going to have cellular connectivity, and it's not going to feed information to us on a live basis. We will only have that information if you become a patient. It remains encrypted on your phone. So some of the petition and the commentary and the criticisms are a result of some misinformation that's out there. So, we have to take some pains to make sure we are very clear about what we're doing and how we're protecting the information. But I think it's not unnatural, it's not unexpected. Anytime you have this type of collection of information, people have concerns about privacy, and it's a natural question. So we have to come out and make sure that we are very clear that we want to protect privacy as far as possible, but that there is a benefit to the public and to the individual. I think some of the comments and concerns, maybe it's because of the number of cases that we have, it looks like we're on a downward slope. And so people are saying, well, you know, things are getting better, maybe everything's okay. We don't need to take the step, which requires a potential risk to privacy. Mm. If you were on the other side and, you know, the number of cases was increasing and this was getting out of control, maybe you'd have a very different view. But that's precisely the point. We're planning for that and we want to prevent that.
So you mentioned this overall skittishness, and I want to bring Brian into this conversation. What's your sense? Because Singapore has seen the proliferation of cameras, for instance, to tackle even e-scooters, to tackle bad drivers and even crime in estates. And the reactions then have been rather muted. And public levels of trust in the government has also been generally high over the years. So why is there this skittishness over concerns of privacy, you think?
When it comes to issues like data protection and legal issues impacting technology, they are what I would call necessary conditions, but not sufficient. Meaning, people who have these concerns, you have to assuage them about these conditions so that they don't raise objections. doesn't necessarily mean that once you address them, they will be happy to start using them. So these are kind of different things, throwing up excuses and reasons and to actually implementing that. So that's one issue. I think the second issue is about what I call privacy by design. And I think one of the things that we want to give great credit to this process is that from inception, when the product was conceptualized, data protection was always considered. And so you see some of the very deliberate decisions that have been taken in the product design, when it was an app as well as now when it becomes a device, those have been addressed and the answers are there. It's just getting that information out. The third thing I would give credit to is, so other than saying it does this and it does that, there will still be a bunch of people who are skeptics and they'll say, okay, that's what you say, but how do you know it does what you say? And one of the important things that we need to point out, and a wider group of people knowing this would be good, is that it was open sourced, meaning the source code, the very code in which the software has been written, is exposed. People can see exactly how it works, how a live version of the software works, and what it does. And so they can then match up and say, okay, look, you know, you say that the data will be destroyed after a certain number of days. The code says that, and the code doesn't lie. It will do that, right? Because the computer just carries out the code. So the open source community has gone through that. The community being not only the open source people here, but overseas as well. And they have said, look, it matches what the government says it does. That should be a great assurance to anyone with questions that, okay, you know, you say it does this, that. How do I know for sure? Somebody has looked at the code level and they have assured that. A lot of that then you realize is based on perception. And perception is also an important factor in accepting a product, right? If we perceive that a product is fun, it's safe to use, we will tend to use it without questioning too much.
Once so what is your sense on what the perception is in this case?
The perception is there's some concern because they see potential with what could go wrong. But that may not be based on reality and what is actually the case, especially when you look at the source code from a code level. That perception needs to be addressed, needs to be corrected, I would suggest. Perhaps also over-talking about it kind of raises the awareness and people get more and more concerned about that. Perhaps there's also a bit more concern because it's a wearable device. Because as a wearable device, you know, you feel like it's closer to you, it's part of you, as opposed to a phone which you could leave away from you. And so there's more concern. But whether that concern is again steeped in reality, that's something I would question.
So just throwing this out to everybody and trying to concretize this a little bit more. People have been so open to giving up information when it comes to logging to Facebook, Joe tagging yourself even, and tagging everyone else on the photograph. Mm. We are able to, and quite happily, give away information. We might read the terms and conditions, well, maybe not, and then say, I agree. And we give that information out. So why is there this level of concern though? Is it something different?
You've hit the nail on the head that there is a lot of things that are on our phone, a lot of services that we access on our phone or in our daily lives online, which actually intrude into our privacy a great deal more than what we're proposing with Trace Together and this proximity tracking. It's just that very often, as you pointed out, people are not aware of it. They're willing to sort of not think about it because what they're getting is fun, it's engaging, it's entertaining, and they very much want it. Because this has a very pure healthcare outcome, there isn't a lot of fun behind it. It's to protect you from a disease. People see it in a different light. But you're right, that there are a whole bunch of things out there where the movies that you watch, the posts that you like and share, the comments that you make online are all, in a way, intruding upon your privacy. And people give up that privacy very willingly. We've taken great pains to make sure that this doesn't come close.
Mm. So we had a poll. We asked all our Facebook users, what are their comments about the Trace Together app? It's quite telling because some people say they're worried about whether data could be collected and used for other purposes. Some examples cited were, will this be used to prosecute me under the Infectious Disease Act for some reason, breaching safe distancing or otherwise, or even be pothmarked? Janio, you mentioned that this is really a logbook that people hand over, they choose to hand over to MOH after they may perhaps get like an infection. What assurances can you give them that this will not be done?
Well, we're committing to it. I mean, we're saying explicitly that personal data that's gathered through Trace Together is only going to be used for contact tracing. We've said so publicly. Minister Vivian Balakrishnan has said so publicly. And the process through which the data is managed, secured, as well as supervised, is very tightly controlled within the very recently announced Public Sector Data Security Review Committee's guidelines, which were established really to deal with exactly this type of problem. How do you make sure that data can be used in service of the public public good and at the same time reassure the public that their protections are there. The way in which the data then gets offloaded, the application, who has access to the database, the way it's encrypted, these are not things made up on the fly. These are very, very particularly designed so that the tool cannot be exploited in the way that people are imagining it can be. This wasn't thrown together ad hoc. This was done in a very deliberate way precisely to protect people. The information is encrypted on the phone. The user themselves can't even access it. And it can't leave the phone just willy-nilly. It has to be deliberately uploaded. And the same is going to be true of the device. The word wearable may be part of why there's a bit of emotional response to this, because people do imagine this is sort of clamped to you or something you can't take off. And I suppose we could have named it a pod, or we've chosen a token. And I think that's in a way to highlight that actually it's not something that's physically going to be attached to you. It's something you choose to clip to you. It's in your bag. It's in your pocket. Then you take it on, you take it off, and you have to carry it with you rather than be attached to you. So we just want to reassure people that that is exactly the way it's designed. The data is going to be used for contact tracing. And really, what is the information that it logs? You know, people worry about POFMA. I'm struggling to understand how, but I'd be happy to have an explanation if one of your listeners can explain. But what does it log? It only logs the Bluetooth signal of another device and the strength. The reason we need the strength is we need to know, were you close or were you far away? And then there's a timestamp so that you can have activity mapping. There is nothing else. There is nothing else. And as you pointed out, because it's open source, people have gone into the app, they've gone into the kind of data that it's storing, and they've demonstrated this by themselves. I mean, it's not just we say so. A whole bunch of people have basically hacked the app because we've made the software open source, and they've demonstrated. There's nothing else being stored in there. There's nothing else that's going to be uploaded.
So Hannah, I just want to ask you what you make of this slippery slope argument that people have been throwing around. What do you think they're concerned about when it comes to, you know, the future of health and what this portends?
Yeah, so this is a really important question. I think that people have the issues now. And as you say, there's also this worry about, okay, if we do this, what comes next? What comes next? Like, where are we heading with this? Listening to those concerns is absolutely vital, because for public health, if you don't have buy-in of the population, it's not going to be an effective response. The whole point of these things is that lots of people are using them and that we're able to get at the population and what's happening. So I think this is a really important conversation to be having and to continue having. And it was great to hear from you, Suling, you know, the public, someone has said this, and, you know, to feed that to the minister and for the minister to be able to really understand why people are concerned about this. And maybe there does need to be a little bit more reassurance. OK, we're doing this now, but we are committing to the same process for anything else that's coming out in the future in terms of tokens, in terms of those kind of health tech things. The other concern that I've heard is around people being forced to use it in those kind of ways. And I think those prosecution was brought up in different ways. And I think this is a really important conversation to also be having, that people do have concerns about, well, if I don't want to use it, what happens? And we really need to understand why people don't want to use it in order for that to not be an issue moving forward.
Well, we would like to exhort people to use it. It's a protection for themselves and for their loved ones, to see it as a good thing.
That's an interesting point, isn't it? You sort of say that maybe the conversation has moved away from that to it being a thing that people are having to use, when actually it should almost be a, well, this is something that we're giving to you to protect you in a way. And it's super interesting how that conversation is happening. And I do think you're right. It might be something to do with the low numbers of cases. We see this with all infectious diseases, as we see the risk perception becomes lower, then people raise questions about what's been done to control it. And that's a really important point.
But this slippery slope argument, I mean, we were worried about that. And that's one of the reasons why we've made sure it's not persistent. The data gets deleted after 25 days. Yeah. And, you know, there's just no way you can avoid that. And that's built into the software. We didn't say the Trace Together personal data is going to be used in general for public health contact tracing, right? It's going to be used for COVID-19 contact tracing. So once this is no longer an issue, we know exactly what we've committed to publicly, and we're going to get rid of it. Your point, Hannah, about this, what people's perception is and the slippery slope argument, we've been there before. If you think of, for example, tuberculosis, we made tuberculosis drug treatment mandatory. If you have tuberculosis, you have no choice. You have to take your medication. And a lot of people don't know this. And today, if you have a conversation with my teenage sons or a 20-year-old, and say, look, there's a mandatory medication out there.
You get spooked, right?
They're like, whoa.
This is serious. I need to look at this.
But
right?
The thing is, that happened at a time when tuberculosis was rampant, and it was a real major public health threat, and people's lives were at risk, our society's structure and fabric were at risk, and people said, okay, this is the right thing to do to protect us, deal with the problem, and it means that if you have tuberculosis, you have to take this drug, you're compelled to, not just for your own good, but to protect people around us. And as a society, we agreed that that was the right thing to do then. We're not going there. I mean, this is a voluntary thing, and it's, you know, we're asking people, look, it's useful to you and to your family. Some of the fears, maybe it's because people are in a sense of comfort and they're all looking forward to opening up and going back out partying and so forth. Yeah. But we got to prepare for it getting worse, and this is part of it.
So, Janio, since you went there, I'm going to go back there. And you talked about making it mandatory. I know there's some skittishness with doing that. The government wants people to be able to proactively do it on themselves, see the need for it, and then download it. But if having an optimum number of downloads is important for this to be effective, you need, I think Minister Vivian Balakrishnan said 75%. We are, is it about 25% or not?
That's right.
If we are convinced that there's an essential need for this, if we are convinced that all these precautions need to be taken, it's very sensible, then what is stopping us from making it mandatory?
Well, because we're still working out how effective this is, right? So I mean, we're still on that development path. It's the same way I don't have a token here to show you. We're still building this and we need to demonstrate exactly how effective this is. Again, it's like the example that I used, the drug therapy. If we had a drug therapy which is only partially effective or, for example, had some very bad side effects, you couldn't make that mandatory. It would be inappropriate. But if you had something which you could demonstrate would prove to be effective, not just for the individual, but controlling a problem for the whole of society, actually, there'd be a call for us to make it mandatory.
So I'm going to ask you then, is it going to be mandatory once you roll it out?
No. It's not. I mean, so our position at the moment is that this is voluntary. We're exhorting people to use it to protect themselves and their families. But let's say one day we demonstrate that, look, this really, really works. And, you know, it protects our society. It allows us to open up international trade, international travel in a safe way, get our economy going. I think there'd be segments of our population that would turn the other way and say, look, why are you not making this compulsory to protect us?
So press the point a little bit more. You have Trace Together app for a couple of months now. Surely there are some use cases that you can use to demonstrate a usefulness and then make it mandatory, just to play the devil's advocate here.
You're pushing for it to be mandatory already.
I'm just wondering what is the tipping point, you know, where's the threshold?
Yeah, well, as I say, it's a work in progress because you're right, we could have chosen to make it mandatory, but we didn't. And part of that was because it needed to be demonstrated. And it's not as if this is operating as the solution. And this is a point we made earlier on. Yeah. This is part of an entire suite of approaches, some of which is tech-based and some of which is professional and it's human-based, all kinds of other information. So you need to have that entire process mature and that entire process develop and then have a very clear sense, what does this bit of technology do for that process? Can you make the case that with this bit of technology being mandatory, you transform the entire process for the public good? Well, then you've made a case for it being mandatory. If you say, well, this bit of technology, it's incremental, it adds, but it doesn't entirely transform it. Well, you've made the case for it to be voluntary and a nice to have, not an essential to have. That question hasn't been answered yet. Yeah. And I think we have to get to the point where we can answer that before we then get into should we or shouldn't we make it mandatory.
But we're kind of in a chicken and egg situation, right? If you can't get your adoption rates high enough voluntarily to be able to create a convincing use case of why it should be mandatory, then you'll never be able to create the use case of making it mandatory.
So, Brian, are you saying that we should be pushing towards legislating it?
No. So I'm saying that if based on what's happening now where the rates are receding, you probably will not have that immediate public health push to make a case for that. You will not be able to get your use case either. And I'm not a fan of mandatory laws for a couple of reasons. One, if you make something like this mandatory where it's down to an individual compliance, some people will try to find ways around it. What will they try to do? Oh, you know, cover in tin foil, let the batteries run out. You know, crazy stuff like that, which kind of defeats the original purpose that you have. Two, I think the enforcement costs to police this, prosecuting people for not wearing it, that would be pretty high. And that's cost that you really do not want to spend at this point in time.
Right, it takes up too much resources also.
That's right. The question for the public policy people will be this. How do you get people to have a certain desired behavior without them actually knowing that that's what you're telling them to do? So instead of saying, okay, you know, you do this or you must do this, how do you encourage people to use it without them really thinking too much about that?
I kind of want to throw this to Hannah as the infectious disease expert in this. Do we have the benefit of time in the face of a pandemic? Do you think that, you know, the low downloads could actually derail plans for contact tracing?
as with everything in this pandemic, we're working in a sort of getting the evidence as quickly as we possibly can and working on sort of partial evidence as we're moving forward. The minister's point about being able to assess how useful this is a really important one. And it would be kind of interesting to hear from those people who are concerned about it, what would be convincing to them? What are the analyses we need to be doing in order to actually assess whether this is, and sort of coming from an epidemiology standpoint, based, you know, we need to be saying, okay, we're going to be looking at these things now, then we need to be analysing those things, and then at the end saying, oh, well, this thing, which it does work, means it's good, kind of thing. But if we've established those now, then we're able to really see clearly, and that should be done independently and kind of in a way that people can be clear that that was something that was happening.
Since you mentioned about how these clarifications are important, I want to go back to our earlier discussion about how all these clarifications on what TraceTogether will be used for have been made publicly, it's been articulated. But Daniel, do you think the government could go one step further to put it in law, put it in writing? Are you ready to ring fence the users of this data somewhere concrete in the Infectious Disease Act or otherwise?
The first thing I'd say, we have put it in writing. I mean, the Hansard is a public record and it's a commitment that is made in public on the record. So firstly, not to say that we haven't put it in writing. It's there. It's also there as part of how we've articulated data security, data privacy in a whole bunch of other ways. It's not that this is sui generis and a de novo type of thing that we've never thought about data privacy, we never thought about the balance between public good and private sector. All that is there as part of how we do data governance. And then we've gone a step further to say, well, and in this case, we're constraining ourselves. So it's there. It's in writing. It's a matter of the public record. And we have no doubt about that. We've made it very clear. If I could just go back to one of the earlier points that you made about this adoption, you know, this sort of chicken and egg, what comes first. The reality is that one of the reasons we haven't been able to get the adoption very high is that this doesn't work very well if you don't have a phone. So, and it doesn't work very well if you're not a person who carries a phone with you all the time. And I know if you're sort of a particular age and a particular generation, you cannot imagine that there are people out there without a phone on them and looking at it all the time. But that is so. And we have needed to then start thinking through the process of hardware device, a token, as well as solving the issue with the Apple operating system, which prevented its functionality in people who have downloaded onto their Apple devices. So we needed to solve both of those problems before we then had a clear roadmap towards the whole population having access to this. And it's only when you then have a roadmap towards the whole population having access to it that you can then really say, what is it going to take to get that adoption all the way up past 80% and effectively then have a very wide base of our population participating in this process.
So it sounds like we're throwing the kitchen sink at this COVID-19 problem, but there are also many other different apps. You know, there's the Safe Entry. And then actually, if you go to NTUC and you don't have your phone with you, you just scan your IC. Or if you don't have your IC, you sort of write it down. There are so many methods. They're very varied. Can you paint the picture for us on how these are all going to come together? Because some people say, look, I want to do my part to play a role to support national contact tracing efforts, but it's just so troublesome. I'm not sure if it's going to work. It's so confusing.
Yes. So firstly, let me burst one bubble. Please be assured it works. I mean, the information that is flowing from the Safe Entry program, it's not an app, it's an entire program, and the Trace Together program is already helping our contact tracers get to protect people faster and more effectively. It works, and we can demonstrate that that is so. Has it worked enough to answer Hannah's question? Well, that's what we've got to keep on going. But it's already started to have its impact.
But are there specific use cases?
Well, the short answer is yes. But I mean, how do you explain it without giving away the details of that person, right? Mm. Again, you want to protect people's privacy. That patient has a right to have his or her privacy protected. So the information is flowing into the process and it is accelerating the process. Mm. Safe Entry, what you've highlighted, it's a program which actually is not, and this is a point of confusion, it's not interchangeable with TraceTogether. TraceTogether is a way to work out who you've been close to, and it's what we call forward contact tracing. If you turn out to be COVID-19 positive, then the contact tracers have a way of isolating and detecting the people whom you might be passing the disease onto. Safe Entry is not trying to answer that question. Actually, it's trying to answer a very, very different question. That question that Safe Entry, the whole program, is trying to answer is, where did you get your disease from? Where have you been over the last 14 days that you may then have picked up COVID-19? So it's not that the information sets are interchangeable, but they link together. So Safe Entry gives us what we call backward contact tracing. Where did you get your disease from? So you're right. When you go to a place, you could use your NRIC, you could use your SingPass mobile, you could also use the TraceTogether app, you could scan the QR code. Actually, what we were trying to do there is not make many, many different apps. We're trying to give you choice and not say you have to do it one way. So you see, this is the flip side of the problem when you then not make some one channel mandatory and you say, well, you've got to multitude of ways to access the Safe Entry program. So each of the things that you've described, actually, you're doing the same thing. You're logging your data into the Safe Entry program. Whether you're using the app, whether you're using your NRIC or your fare card and so forth, it's exactly the same place that the data is going.
Right, so you're taking many bets on many horses.
Well, it's a recognition that people have different ways of verifying their identity. And so we felt that some people would prefer to be able to just scan their NRIC. Some people would like the convenience of using an app on their phone. And even on their phone, some people would like to do it through a QR code or an app, because phones are different generations, different ages, different capabilities. So it's not so much so many bets, it's was a recognition that if you ask people to check in every time you come to a venue, there are different ways of doing that and different people will respond to that in a sort of a different way. And we wanted to give people some choices. Over time, yes, we might see some simplification. And as we understand, people are not using one route or would prefer an upgrade to the app to help them do it better and faster, we'll do that. We didn't have time to get all of this nicely beta tested and user tested and have a nice polish, developer's launch. We had to do this on the fly and we'll refine it over time.
Okay, so just one question before we all end this. It's quite clear that tech has been quite critical to our COVID fight. What do you think we have learned from this pandemic that will help make this a much smoother process going forward? Do you have a wish list of what you hope to see in Singapore's fight against COVID-19 in the months ahead?
Oh, that's a tough question. So I think we're seeing, as the Minister said, a sort of proliferation of the ways in which tech is being used. And I think that's a really important thing to think about, that it's not just an app. It's not just scanning things. It's a whole suite of things that are being used there. There's going to be tech being used within hospitals to kind of understand disease and those kind of things. So there's a lot going on and there will continue to be a lot going on. And I think maybe what we're learning from here is the need for that openness, the need for the explanation of what's going on and the need for the explanation of how things are being used and why are they being used and what's going on. And I think the government here has been very open in terms of cases and in terms of what's going on. And hopefully that sort of continues with any tech that's coming forward.
So I think I agree with what Hannah has said. Tech is part of the solution, but let's not also kid ourselves. It's not the only solution. It won't solve every problem with COVID-19, just like tech will not solve every problem in this world. Learning how to get those adoption rates up, that might be the key to it right now. And sometimes it's difficult, I understand that. It's possible. The example I keep thinking about is the Healthy 365 program, right? It's pretty difficult to sign up, get a device, line up at a post office, collect it, set it up. But 1 million over people have done that, even though it's pretty difficult. Why? Because we've kind of changed the thinking to, you must do this, but direct that behavior towards people. They like the points. They like the thrill of logging the points and comparing it with their friends and tying it up with everything else. And if we can then start focusing on how do we get that adoption rates up without people focusing too much on why this could be bad for me and stuff like that. It is good. You know, it's good. Gamification might be one of the techniques that you pick up. Once we get that up, you know, I'll be very interested to see the real use cases. To be fair, I don't think any country has got the adoption rates up to the levels that they want it to be. But having said that, look, in Singapore, we have pretty smart people. We've got a lot of tech companies here. Some of them have obviously figured out how to get adoption rates up. We can always draw lessons from that and, you know, work from there.
So, Janio, take us home. Do you think we can be the ones to beat this trend? After all, so many other countries have adopted some sort of a contact tracing app, but the download numbers have been quite poor.
Well, indeed. So the point that both of you have just made is that actually we have one of the highest adoption rates in the world. Even though it is not at the target that we wanted, it's 1.8 million Singaporeans have been convinced that this is the right thing to do. Mm. It's 25%, but we're on par with Finland as being the two countries with the highest penetration rate of this type of technology. And well, we've got to close some of those gaps and improve, as we've discussed. Mm. If I had these sort of wishes and aspirations, where we're going to go from here? Well, I hope that our use of technology allows us then to adapt. This is my first wish. Adapt. I don't think COVID is something you're going to solve or get rid of or cure. You need that aggressive adaptation so that all the things that we thrived on as Singapore can somehow be defended and allowed to continue in a COVID world. Technology is going to be a key part of that, but it's not the only part of that, as we've repeatedly said. I think my second wish, my second wish is that I hope that we can use technology not just in a sort of defensive way, a reactive way to deal with COVID and just adapt, but maybe even in an active way to solve some of the problems. And I know some of this work is going on, people looking at using some of our artificial intelligence and pivoting some of our computing resources to look at drug discovery, to look at vaccine. But even more than that, perhaps analyze all this information that's now available about COVID-19. It's a new disease. We're just learning all the sort of intricacies of it. The amount of biomedical technology that we have here in Singapore perhaps can give us some insights. And then my third wish, actually, we have to ask, why is it that we're even having this conversation today where we're one of those countries with one of the highest adoption rates and able to deploy these technologies and have this kind of discussion about data governance and the right trade-offs and how we're going to think about epidemiology going forward? Well, it's because we've come a long way and we have that tech base and we have people who are skilled Singaporeans who are trained in this, who understand technology, digitally literate. That's going to be a key part of something that we haven't spoken a lot about today, but will be important in terms of the next couple of years, which is how do we deal with the economic consequences coming out of COVID-19, reinvigorate our economy and create jobs. Technology and technology-related jobs are going to be a key part of that. And I hope that's one of the key takeaways that we can have from COVID-19 coming out of the crisis, that Singapore is a place where we can use technology, not just to fight the disease, but to support our entire way of life.
Yeah, a lot of big wishes there. Three, but very big wishes.
I was going to make good use of my time.
Okay. Thank you so much, Minister Janiel, Hannah and Brian, for coming down today. And there you have it, the brewing questions over Trace Together, contact tracing in Singapore, answered by the government and the experts. The people who make this podcast possible, Crispina Robert, our podcast editor, and Erin Lowell, research writer. And I'm Lin Su Ling, signing off from this episode of Heart of the Matter.